Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segretto, and this is Franchise Today. We're back live after a month off for the holiday break and looking forward to another strong season of Franchise Today as we come out of winter, get into spring, and move forward into the rest of the year. Hopefully, everybody's already in line with achieving their goals and objectives. I have on with me today my co-producer, Joe Caruso. Joe, welcome, and welcome back after a great holiday season.
Well, thanks, Paul. It's great to resume the Franchise Today show with you and bring great content to the franchise community on things that are important to franchising and franchise organizations.
It looks like you have another great show lined up today, as my guest is Court Williams, Partner North America at HVS Executive Search, and we'll be bringing Court on here shortly. Tell us a bit about some upcoming shows as we enter a very exciting time in franchising with the upcoming IFA convention as well.
Well, certainly we have a great show today with Court, and I've known Court for nearly 15 years. But next week we have a great guest as well. His name is Bob Coleman, and he just finished writing a book, Money, Money, Everywhere, But Not a Drop for Main Street. And Bob is probably the country's foremost expert on franchise and small business lending. And Bob is going to be a great guest because I've seen him on Fox Business. I've seen him on CNBC. I've seen him on Fox News. So I think it's a great topic. The guest is certainly the expert in the lending space. So this is something that's going to be important to franchising, certainly, because you got to sell franchises, but you got to get them open, and you don't get them open without financing. And then we've got a great show locked and loaded for the 9th. Bob Coleman will be on next week with Dina Dwyer Owens, and she's going to be coming right off of being on Undercover Boss. So that was a real coup getting Dina to agree to be on the show. We'll have a lot to talk about. We'll guess we'll just have to wait for Undercover Boss to air to figure out what the show's really going to be about. So that should be pretty darn exciting. And Dina will be the second person we've had from Undercover Boss on, because we had Shelley Sun from Bright Star on the end of last year. So we're starting off the year right, Paul.
Absolutely. And the thing that I'm really excited to, of course, I love the fact that Dina's going to be on Undercover Boss here towards the end of January and has agreed to come on the show and talk about it. But, you know, February 9th is the lead-in show to the IFA convention. And, of course, everybody knows in franchising that Dina was the chairwoman for the IFA in 2010. Actually, 2009, I believe. Because Ken Walker was the year before last, and last year was Jack Earl. So Dina really has a lot of insight. She's on all the committees, been involved in a lot of the committees at the IFA, and really can give us some insight and that last-minute push leading into the IFA convention. And, of course, as I said, the onset of the show, there's a lot of exciting things going on in franchising. And you, as the president of the Capital Area Franchise Association, I know you have a very important event coming up next week. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, we meet at CAFA every 2 months, and the vast majority of CAFA members are also IFA members. But we are fortunate enough to have Steve Caldera on January 17th to talk about franchising, kind of a year in review, and what to look forward in 2012. And we've got an hour and 15 minutes to hear Steve speak. I don't even know if he's going to be able to scratch the surface on all that he's accomplished and all that he's working on in terms of bettering franchising, bettering the economy, the economics for franchising in terms of financing and legislation. So it should be a terrific, terrific opportunity to hear Steve speak.
Well, that's great. And also remind our listening audience that you do not have to be a member of CAFA to attend the event. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly, we would welcome anybody who would want to be a member. It's pretty much a regional Baltimore, Washington group, and all they have to do to sign up to come to the event on Tuesday is go to CAFAfranchise.org, and you can register online and get yourself a seat. And we'll be meeting in Columbia, Maryland, at King's Contrivance, which is a fabulous restaurant there. So the food is even good. So we do better than rubber chicken.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that one well because she invited me to speak there last July, and it was really a nice place. There's also some more exciting things going on for Franchise Today as we're in the planning stage for our third annual Franchise Legal Series, which right now is going to run from Thursday, April 12th, for 7 consecutive weeks, which would be the same number of shows we did in 2011. And that'll take us through May 24th, where we wrap up the legal series with the IFA Legal Symposium recap. And right in the middle of the series also, as the multi-unit conference will be going on Las Vegas, I'm sure we'll have one of the attorneys on talking about multi-unit legal issues. So as we get more information and line up more guests for the Franchise Legal Series, we'll be announcing it. So look for it, and I'm sure, Joe, that you've got some great thoughts in mind and perspective and planning for the Franchise Legal Series, and I'm certainly looking forward to it.
Well, we do, Paul, and people in franchising have really come to rely on the Legal Series to get them good information for a lot of the people within their organizations that are maybe new to franchising or maybe moving ahead in their career and they need some additional learning and discovery. But I think a lot of people also look at it for reinforcement. They want to be reminded of what best practices are from a legal and compliance standpoint. And we're going to deliver again this year on the promise to bring them good content.
Great. Looking forward to it. A couple of other quick announcements. If you look at the Franchise Essentials blog at fmbpro.com, you'll see we're real excited about the Fran Summit series, continuing riding high off the success of the Franchise Social Media Summit that was last September. God, it seems like so long ago. Joe was one of the speakers along with 8 other speakers in that action-packed, information-packed day. And we'll be rolling out an entire series of events for 2012. And 2 of the ones coming up, and these are free webinars, next Wednesday, that'll be January 18th, Elements Local webinar will be on, and it's produced by Fran Summit. Look for that information, as well as on January 31st, there'll be another free webinar, this one by Sistino. Again, it'll be produced by Fran Summit. So a lot of exciting things going on, and nothing is more exciting today than introducing my guest, Court Williams. Court comes to HVS Executive Search with over 20 years of executive search experience in the hospitality industry. His background also includes leading the Human Resources Department with Sparrows, an international restaurant chain, and 9 years in restaurant operations throughout the United States. Court has served as a student coach with Cornell University's Hospitality Leadership Development Institute since 1998 and is also an executive coach for MBA students at the Johnson School of Business. In 2009, he was appointed to the Advisory Council for Washington, D.C.-based New Brand Analytics, a firm which provides real-time consumer insight intelligence to hospitality companies through the use of social media. Court earned his Bachelor of Science degree in Hotel Administration from Cornell University. Court, welcome to Franchise Today.
Paul, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here, and Happy New Year to everyone.
Yes, Happy New Year for sure, and hopefully everybody's New Year is starting off on the right foot, and I'm glad to be starting off Franchise Today's New Year with you as my guest. But, you know, before we get into our topic today, Court, of optimizing human capital strategies for success and profit in the 21st century. Maybe you could share with our audience your transition and career path from hands-on restaurant management and franchised and chain human resources executive to be one of the most well-respected of executive search professionals in the business today.
Well, thanks, Paul. I'll give you the short version because it's quite a lengthy story. But I had an opportunity to open a restaurant as a general manager in my late 20s in a very tough labor market, Darien, Connecticut, whereby when we put out the advertisement to staff the restaurant, literally no one showed up. So I had to get creative, put together a recruiting strategy that included college visits and other avenues, and successfully staffed 230 employees. And that caught the eye of the COO of the Louisville-based company, where employees were very plentiful. This was a very challenging market here in the Northeast, and was actually offered the opportunity to become the corporate recruiter for Chi-Chi's Mexican restaurants. This was in the early 80s when they were opening restaurants almost daily, and it was a very challenging position. I had great mentorship there by the VP of HR in interviewing skills and utilizing various techniques to select best-in-class management. While I was at Chi-Chi's in that position, I was in that position about 2 years, I was recruited by a search firm for the head of human resources at Sbarro, which was a newly public company. And they had no one in that spot at the time. And quite honestly, I didn't feel particularly qualified for the position. But at the same time, recruitment was a large part of that role. And I guess they figured, and I figured, I could learn the generalist aspect of that job, which I ultimately did. And in that role, I was responsible, because we had a very limited executive search budget at that time, but was responsible for recruiting all key C-level department heads. So I would deploy, you know, some internal methodology around that, as well as retain select search firms on those positions where I had less knowledge, and successfully staffed the company during a very, very high growth period in the 80s, especially being a mall-driven concept. Malls were being developed right and left during those years. It was interesting, having been exposed to executive search while in that position, I was enamored with the profession, didn't know a lot about it, and ultimately accepted an opportunity with a firm. I felt it would give me a greater bandwidth of exposure to different organizations, you know, learn about different cultures, businesses, and that's ultimately what I love about what I do today. And so I've been in it now, you know, 20 plus years.
Well, that is absolutely awesome. We actually have some common background, if you would, only in the fact that, you know, my brother went to Cornell University, and my dad actually had Mrs. Sbarro as one of his customers back in the 50s. So just some points. Court, the Franchise Today show has a varied audience, as you might know, of established franchisors, startup franchise companies, multi and single unit franchisees in many different channels of business. And, Joe and I think that our listeners would benefit from knowing more about the mechanics of how an executive search actually works from the hiring side of the equation and, of course, from the candidate side. You know, can you give us some of the broad stroke basics on that?
Yeah, the best way to answer that is explain, I think, a process, because there's more involved in an executive search than most realize. It really starts, you know, once retained, starts with a discussion around the position and why the position is open, get a little history around it. Is it a newly created position? Is it a replacement for someone? If so, why did that person not succeed, or were they recruited away, to get a little color around that. And also get a sense as to why there may not be a successor in that position, because sharp candidates, especially at the C level, will ask those questions. So, we get information around that. The next step is to really dig into the organization, and we conduct at HVS what's called a cultural assessment. And it's really conducted by meeting with all key decision makers and members of management that I feel will have a viewpoint not only on the mechanics of the position, but really around what makes the company tick culturally. What are the core values? That information is absolutely critical to defining the profile of the position and the dimensions around it. You know, what type of style and personality would fit in the organization. And from that information, we then craft a very detailed profile, and out of that profile identify really 10 core dimensions that we'll interview against and actually rank candidates during the interview process. We here start with actually a targeted company list versus who do we know type of an approach, and that's certainly what our clients are paying for. We'll target companies and within those organizations, while we'll know most of the C-suite and key members of management, you know, those that maybe we don't know, we go out and recruit to make sure we have a full array of candidates. We then certainly go through recommendation and referral from some of the more esteemed people in the industry that we know and have relationships with. We recruit through that list, put together a ranked shortlist presentation whereby we present to the client. We will also, and we'll get into this maybe later, utilize an assessment tool, which certainly helps with the interview process from the client perspective. And then obviously we'll negotiate the compensation package. Because compensation has gotten quite complex, we actually have a division within our firm that addresses that. And compensation is really geared now more than ever through pay for performance. So we'll help design bonus programs, commission programs, whatever the position requires, and then close the deal, set a start date, and then we do a very thorough follow up to be sure that the individual is onboarded properly. So it's quite a process, and a typical executive search will take, on average, between 60 and 120 days. So that's really the process. From the candidate perspective, if you're being represented, I think it's just very important that that you align with your search consultant. You communicate throughout. There's no hidden agendas. Open up an honest and clear communication line with your search consultant, as well as the consultant to the candidate. We keep our candidates updated ongoingly through the process, and obviously if they're not a shortlisted or selected candidate, they'll know that as soon as possible so they can move on with their other endeavors. And we also ensure confidentiality. That goes without saying.
Something that always seems to confuse people and is the difference between retained search and contingency search. What is the difference, and what are the pros and cons for each of them?
That's a good question, Paul, and I think there is a lot of confusion around that. I'll start with, the contingency side, because it's a very, very different business from the retained approach. Contingency firms, more often than not, represent individuals, candidates seeking placement. They usually search for lower-level organizational positions versus the VP or C-suite. They tend to spend little time initially on the cultural assessment I spoke of earlier, even meeting with the organization, and many times they don't meet with candidates. It's very much resume flow and representing candidates for opportunities. The other key point is that a contingency firm is under no obligation to guarantee or produce results because it's a contingency fee arrangement. They're really paid on placement only. That, I guess, could be an advantage to a client company that is using contingency firms or firms, because oftentimes they'll call a couple for an assignment. in conjunction with their own internal strategy. So that and they're not required to pay, so there's no financial commitment per se. They're also never assured really any confidentiality, so that would be a con, I would say. And you really don't have the commitment of the recruiter because they're doing this on with multiple clients. On the retain side, retain firms really represent companies and the opportunity itself. They conduct assignments on an exclusive contract basis only. A retained firm must know the client organization as well as the position requirements and the culture and the values of the organization. We spoke about how we get that information, and from that we create the profile. Reputable firms, you know, offer a guarantee of candidate success and are very committed to thorough and ethical practices and results, including an off-limits policy. I think from a pro standpoint, you have a fully committed team of high-level, high-thinking recruiters. It's very consultative, so we get very involved in the inner workings of the organization, help profile the positions. Possibly even with this downturn since 2008, there's been such a what I call a human capital correction, and now companies are selectively, you know, hiring positions, but they're quite different from what they had. And we help craft those positions. Oftentimes, two positions are combined in one, greater bandwidth of responsibility. So from a consultative standpoint, we really get into the guts of an organization and help advise, you know, who is the right what is the right profile and who would be the right cultural fit. So I think you get that consultative piece also around, you know, compensation and pay per performance models that'll attract best in class. It's a very streamlined process. We have targeted calls, so there's ongoing communication with the search committee or a search committee lead. I guess if you consider it a negative, you know, we don't, because we see great results in return on investment in using the retain model, but you are financially committed through an initial retainer to the process. But with that, you get a committed team. Those are really the primary differences.
You know, Joe, I know having been a C-level executive at several large national brands and taking on the responsibility of hiring for several positions, I know you and I have had discussions about, you know, using internal resources and using an executive recruiter. What's your experience been on both sides of that coin? And then I'd like to, you know, lob the question to Court about telling us when it would be right for an organization to use an executive recruiter instead of their internal resources.
Well, I've used, of course, internal resources to field jobs. It's you know, it's very cost effective, but at the same time, where we did not have internal competency and knowledge about a specific kind of position, we went outside and we chose the retained route because we wanted to have dedicated resources against it, and it worked out very, very well for us. I still think that you know, there's kind of confusion on contingency versus retained, and I think people opt for the contingency because they think it's all about resume flow. And you know, when you've got a critical hire and you're trying to fill a particular position, the cost of making a mistake far outweighs the cost of the retained search, especially for C-level hires. And I think it's a small price to pay to go into the relationship with that new hire with a degree of certainty that they're going to be successful, or at least a greater degree of certainty that they're going to be successful, as opposed to, all right, I got this resume from a headhunter, and this is the tallest pygmy, and I picked them.
Court, you know, with that in mind, give me your perspective. How does an organization know when it's actually right to use an executive recruiter instead of their internal resources?
Well, Paul, I think it's essential that if a client company wants a truly thorough canvassing of the best talent out there, and I think the most important point is uncovering candidates that have compelling reason to even be looking for an opportunity, but they're best in class in their own organization. We can, as a retained firm, can uncover those people through long-lasting relationships. And, you know, we have access to those candidates. So if you're conducting an internal search or even on a contingency basis whereby, again, it's mostly influx of resumes of those looking for positions, you're not having access to anyone that could be the right person for the job that is so focused on their current opportunity and position that they're not out there looking and wouldn't even be aware of the opportunity. So I think that is probably the most critical point in deciding on, you know, how extensive of a search you want. You won't get that from the contingency side. I think also there's a feeling that you need to be a large organization to retain a search firm, and I would say our practice is a nice combination of small startup, post-startup, turnaround, and large public organizations, and they all come to us for different reasons. I think this is, since we're addressing the franchise community, you know, if you take a franchisor, you know, you have a group of franchisees that are paying, you know, in the area of 5% royalty of their sales to ensure success. So our, you know, franchisors tend to come to us for those executives that really support the franchisees and ensure, you know, their success and that they're able to meet their franchise development agreement. So, you know, obviously the CEO that's going to steer the brand in the right direction, we do our fair share of that. But I think the other key positions that you'd want to consider using a retained firm for from a franchisor perspective would certainly be ops support and training. And that can take a number of different titles from, you know, VP of operations, COO, operating partner, VP of training, but that true ops support to ensure brand standards are met. Absolutely, the marketing side of it, we get many calls. Marketing also to position the brand against what's become a very crowded field, certainly in the hospitality industry. And within that marketing, the ability to create and launch new and innovative products, whatever those products may be, food or in the case of hotels, room products. Absolutely, one of the I think most important roles would be your VP of franchise development or chief development officer. That person is representing your brand, what you stand for, and is the the gateway as to who comes into the organization as franchisees, and certainly not having the right person in that position. It could spell disaster for the organization, and I have seen it. So I think having a strong franchise development executive, we then with that position, you know, tailor a commission structure that really ensures that they're not out just signing up franchisees, but also signing up franchisees that are going to be committed to the brand standards that are referenced, and not just someone that can write a check. And I think that's another very, very important position. From a franchisee perspective, I think probably the most critical hire and one that we see quite a bit is the operating partner. If you were to secure, you know, a 50 business unit development contract, and as a franchisee, your expertise was more on the development side or financial side, absolutely you need a best-in-class operating partner that is not only going to build that field team to get these operations up and running per brand standards, Also participating with development site selection, that's a key role there, and ensuring that development schedule is met. If a franchisee certainly doesn't work out, that's not good for anyone. So if it's a public company, that's disclosed and can certainly hurt the brand. So getting back to the question, those are positions that I think are critical to cast a wide net and invest, because the return will be there.
We're broadcasting live. This is Franchise Today. It's our first segment back after the new year. And I'm Paul Segretto, along with my co-producer, Joe Caruso, and our guest, Court Williams, partner North America at HBS Executive Search, as we're talking about optimizing human capital strategies for success and profit in the 21st century. You know, Court, a lot of times, franchise executives get together, such as Joe and myself, and we talk a lot about recruitment, and it's hard not to talk about recruitment from a staff standpoint as well as from a franchisee standpoint. It seems like there's a lot of parallels between, executive recruitment and franchise recruitment. And in my experience with franchise companies, I see management agonize a lot and put a great deal of energy into either recruiting process. As I said, it parallels franchise development, but let me shift back to what we're talking about, executive recruitment, because when it comes to onboarding at all levels, it seems that many times new hires, just as in the franchise development side, new candidates, are left to themselves to figure out what to do now that they have, their new job. So kind of the proverbial, give the new player the ball and expect them to run with it. How can companies, after a successful executive recruitment, ensure that the new hire is positioned best for success in their new role?
Well, it's such a relevant topic today, Paul, because I think, it used to be the old adage, a six-week training program, a basic orientation, and then launch the employee or a member of management was enough. I think today it really has gone beyond that. There's an interesting statistic that I read that if there isn't a proper onboarding mentoring program, the executive is 58% more likely to not be with that company after 3 years. And that was an interesting stat that I read recently. And there's a 50% more failure rate of retaining executives with no program. So I think setting up an onboarding mentoring program is really what we advise at HBS. New hires come into an organization, they're filled with expectations in their new role, but they really lack knowledge of how things really work. You don't really learn a lot about that in an interview process. You'll get bits and pieces. So there's really a high risk of early turnover if they're not onboarded correctly. They may be disillusioned. They may be they could be told something that's not happening once they start. And if there's no real conduit to a mentor, that's risky. And you lose an employee, I think the stat's three times their salary it's going to cost you by the time you factor in the time and expense to recruit someone and what you've had to pay them the short time that they're there. So I think it's really critical that new hires, know how their own positions and careers fit into the overall organization structure, and how that role links with their career goals. I mean, that really, I think, is an ongoing conversation you can have with a mentor. I think with a mentor, there's really no better way to learn than from someone who's lived the experience, can teach quickly the way things are done, and really help ramp up an incoming employee on the culture of the company. I mean, a lot of times, more often than not, new employees come into an organization with what I call some employment baggage. They have preconceived attitudes, norms. They have experiences from other cultures and companies. And even though you've done a thorough job of trying to match that person with your own organizations, there's always you know, some baggage that comes along with that. And I think, you know, having some awareness of that and having a mentor, being able to sort of guide that person from, you know, one way of thinking to their way of thinking really does reduce the risk of you know, any, you know, short-term exit of that person. So it's becoming a you know, a fairly often used term now, onboard mentoring. I think the other subset of that would be cultural onboarding, which really I think is digs into, you know, changing the attitudes, norms, and experiences of the incoming employee, but hugely, you know, relevant. I mean, having a mentor, I think, really aligns the expectations, you know, of the employee with the real realities of the job. They help really paint an honest picture. You know, you want to provoke a culture of honesty and clarity and transparency, I think, in today's world. And a mentor through an onboarding process can really help with that. And I think that mentors really could come from any department. If you were brought in as a VP of finance, your mentor doesn't have to be your CFO. Your mentor could be the VP of HR. So it's not really about the skill mentorship. It's really about the cultural onboarding mentorship. So, you know, a critical part of it, and it really will help, you know, guarantee that that return on investment that you've put into the hiring process sticks. So,
yeah, certainly culture is a very big part of it. And as I was listening to you speak, I kind of put on the franchise development thinking cap and was thinking that, you know, mentorship, you know, really should be used in that onboarding process as well. You know, you talk about culture, and you can't read in a business book or listen to a business guru at a conference nowadays without, you know, reading or hearing about the importance of company culture. I know even this morning on Twitter, I retweeted and posted several different articles that were out today in the various Smart Briefs newsletters about company culture. And I think by now, you know, we all know it's important, but how does culture factor into the executive recruiting process?
Well, I think I touched on that a little before, and I'll just, you know, reiterate it because it's that important. It's really essential in creating a true profile of the opportunity. And, you know, I think the finding the right skill sets is certainly less arduous than finding the right person with the skill sets that fits the culture. So you need to do your homework. You need to get into the heads of the decision makers that will be a part of the interview process. And then, you know, once you craft your profile and sort of target, have a discussion, you know, with the team that you've met with to be sure that, you know, you've got all your T's crossed and I's dotted with respect to really the type of a person that's going to fit. I mean, there's always going to be some percentage of it that will be, you know, gut to some extent. But, you know, with the use of some more sophisticated assessment tools that are out there today, you know, that will certainly, you know, certainly help with ensuring a cultural fit. But, yeah, it's hugely important.
You know, I often think back with all the change going on in technology and communications. I think a lot about Bob Dylan's old song, "The Times They Are Changing," and certainly recruitment, executive recruitment over the past 20 years has changed. So in your experience, you know, in what ways, how are the best of breed organizations, big and small, like improving their selection process and strategies, and how has that changed over the past 20 years?
Well, I think that, you know, probably the headline there over the last 20 years and probably more in the last, you know, 10, retained executive search firms have really taken on much more of an advisory role. And I think gone are the days where someone in personnel or HR would forward over an internal job description and they say, you know, go find someone that fits this. You know, who, you know, it's just not thorough enough. So, Firms like ours, we take on an advisory role from designing pay-per-performance comp plans, designing individual development plans, designing profiles of positions. But it's very important to understand the goals and the direction of the organization, because people are going to take you there. And typically when we go in to assess an opportunity, a search or searches, we take the time to dig into even more than that, to see and map out their organization as to whether they have the right people in place and the right departments to meet their goals, whether that is a rapid growth situation, whether that's a turnaround situation, a new launch, could be a number of different scenarios. So you need the right types of people to meet your goals. So, a true retained search firm would act as an advisor in that, and all these things tie into one another. How you pay someone, how you develop someone in succession development, using assessment tools to benchmark high performers so you can profile against that in the new search you're conducting. So, past success oftentimes predicts future success. So there's a lot of thinking around that, a lot of consultative work around that, and I think that's really where it's changed. A true partnership versus how, some firms in the past have looked at firms as maybe a necessary evil because they can't find someone on their own. I think today, companies that understand and value the service of a retained executive search firm are quicker out of the gate just to move ahead and select a firm that's best for them.
Certainly, we can't talk about 20 years of changes without discussing how LinkedIn has affected executive research search. What is your opinion with a lot of companies that say, well, I don't need an executive search firm anymore, I could just find what I need on LinkedIn? And how do recruiters use LinkedIn nowadays as an added resource?
Again, I think LinkedIn is an added tool. We use LinkedIn only to gain more information or access to candidates. We don't necessarily recruit right off LinkedIn because, again, there's a lot more behind that LinkedIn profile page that needs to be learned. I think it's a great resource. It's one that certainly organizations do use selectively, possibly for, in-house recruiting, but we use it as an adjunct to our sourcing strategy, and that's it. But I'm a fan of LinkedIn for I think all the reasons anyone's a fan of Facebook, LinkedIn, and other forms of social media, and I think it can be incorporated into a very professional process.
Joe, you and I have had numerous conversations about predictive assessments. Did you have a question for Court with respect to predictive assessments and even pre-employment testing?
Well, I'm a big fan of predictive assessments. I think that they can be very, very valuable. I also feel like they can be a tool that's misused. And I'd love for Court to expand on kind of the methodology of using predictive assessments and maybe differentiate between what good ones are and what bad ones are and how they weigh into the process. How much weight should a hiring authority put on the predictive assessment in making the decision? Because if it was easy enough to use a predictive assessment to choose your new hire, you wouldn't need the recruiter and you wouldn't need an HR department. You could just use the computer and it would pop out somebody that was good.
Yeah, Joe, of course, we use our own proprietary assessment here at HVS called the 2020 assessment that my partner, Dr. Jim Horan, put together in conjunction with Cornell University. So we use an assessment for all our candidates and provide the results in addition to some select behavioral-based interview questions for our shortlisted candidates, which certainly helps our client companies in that process, but by no means should an assessment be a knockout in the selection process. We feel that an assessment really can be used for the life cycle of the employee from, another tool, really probably more around a cultural fit in the selection process, but certainly a very valuable internal tool ongoingly for succession development, ongoing communication. So assessments, I think, have to be used in the right way. Some of our clients use them in more depth than others. I think using an assessment to maybe understand how a candidate, what makes them tick, you know, kind of learn a little bit more about their style. Our assessment is not a personality test. And I would say, you know, I don't want to judge good versus bad, but we created our own proprietary assessment tool because we really didn't feel any of those that were out there, including some that we had used in the past, really addressed hospitality enough. And in some cases, they weren't legally defensible. I think that's a big piece, that these tests are not biased in any way based on your educational or social background or anything of that nature, and a good assessment will be able to read into that and give you the accurate results. I think the other really productive way to use an assessment is to assess your high performers, maybe your mid performers and your lower producing members of management or executive team, and that information can really help us in a couple ways. One, designing performance management, individual performance management plans for those individuals as part of succession development. But I think even more importantly, from an executive search standpoint, we're able to profile success based off those assessments in that organization. So they can be used in a very, very productive way. But again, in a selection process, by no means should they be a knockout factor.
You know, we talked about culture, we talked about predictive assessments, we talked about, you know, pre-employment testing. It leads us to actually sitting down with a candidate, and generally, you know, whether you use a recruiter or in-house resources, Court, what are some of the more common pitfalls you've seen in the interviewing and candidate selection process?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to my mind is, you know, I tend to see, you know, some less experienced interviewers, believe that liking a candidate might mean the candidate is the right person for the job. And that's a very easy emotion to let guide you to a decision, because they may just feel, wow, I'd like to work for this individual or with this individual. They seem to get along with everyone here. But that's not really a deep enough dive, and that's why we've talked about some of these other methodologies that will ensure, you know, a more accurate hire. I think the other probably common pitfall is, you know, when an organization is feeling the crunch, they may be down a person or two in critical decision-making positions, that they'll rush a process, they'll panic hire. They may not get enough people involved in the interview process because of travel schedules and, things of that nature, kind of logistical issues they let get into the way. We all know you make a wrong decision based on, you know, running a poor process or a rushed process or, you know, an impetuous hire based on liking someone, you know, that can be hugely costly. Probably the last thing is not doing enough deep dive on reference checking. We certainly do that from our process. Those are probably the three: rushing the process, you know, letting your emotions sort of take charge of you as far as liking someone versus being the right person, and maybe not a thorough enough reference checking.
I see. So let me ask you a question, and I know this is on a lot of people's minds. As we hear things or read things in the news about, you know, whether credit checks should be part of the employment process, and of course, you know, we start looking at, you know, background and reference checks. You know, how are they essential to the hiring process, or are they really just a necessary evil?
Well, I think reference checks are an important part of the process. But just given the legal ramifications of saying the wrong thing to the wrong person, oftentimes you don't really get a true reference, and I think most people are probably aware of that. I think it's probably the weakest component of a corporate HR hiring process, and a lot of times it's references are. They can be arduous trying to track someone down. They're, oftentimes that responsibility is delegated to an administrative person or not a hiring manager. So how thorough of a job you're really getting. Many times employers, rely 100% on memory. They don't, they're not really utilizing maybe past performance appraisals to get back to the person referencing on some real accurate data. And again, a lot of employers do not want to expose that. They don't want to face, any legal action. So, I think you got to be careful with back channel referencing, which I know is common out there. You really have to, be very selective. I think it's still a relevant part of the process, but you need to be careful and selective on how you do it.
And what about respect to, background checks, criminal checks, and credit checks? Are they a necessary evil or are they essential?
Well, we give our clients an option. We don't do that in-house. We have a third party that will handle that. I find that most of our clients will take that next step. I think it's important. But there are those organizations that don't deploy that. There's certainly very reputable third-party firms out there that do a very thorough job of that, whether it's checking educational background to ensure the degrees are accurate, that the resume lines up, if there are any, criminal activity, why not? It's easily accessed. You just want to minimize making any type of mistake given the investment. So, that's typically done by a third party that specializes in that area.
And as we talk about, these different background checks and we look back at how things have changed over the last 20 years, how much does a social media check play into the equation?
I haven't seen a whole lot of that, Paul, in my experience, or any real discussion around that. But I certainly know that, the buzz is out there, and I tell my own kids, be careful what you put on that Facebook, because I know certain employers, certainly those that are maybe more contemporary thinking and of the generation where they're on Facebook, ongoingly, do utilize it more. And if they're looking at a group of shortlisted candidates, going to Facebook to get a better sense as to, how they live their lives, could be relevant. I just don't hear a lot of commentary around it. Maybe some of my partners have, but me personally, no.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is, still this unknown area. And we've had, several attorneys on Franchise Today within the last 6 months that have touched on that subject. But I think that a big reason is that, a lot of people, it's the unknown. Am I allowed to look at that? Can I divulge that? Are they looking at it but not divulging it? But is it still, part of the process? And, of course, as I often preach in a lot of my speaking engagements about social media, is, what goes on in Las Vegas stays on Facebook and YouTube and certainly could be found forever, especially when attorney Jonathan Redgrave told us back in September on Franchise Today that all tweets on Twitter are being archived by the Library of Congress. That definitely is a daunting thought that even anything in passing that might be said online is being archived and for people to see. Things can come out of the woodwork at one time or another to bite somebody proverbially where. And, you know, and it might not be now, but it might be down the road when they're looking to get into a leadership position. And leads me to my next question and probably our last question. You know, why is it important and when is it time for a company to have a leadership succession plan in place? And how would you recommend they begin that process?
Well, first, I think succession planning, we like to use the term succession development because plans don't develop anyone. Development experiences really develop people. So I think it's a better term that we like to use. I think it's the responsibility of any supervisor at any level to practice succession development from day one. You know, if you're a general manager of a restaurant or a hotel, you should be looking for your successor within the ranks. Certainly, if you're a member of the board of directors, you should always be targeting a successor to the CEO. I think it's a responsibility of a supervisory position and one that should be measured with respect to their performance. I think that, you got to be careful to keep it simple, the whole process that I find that some companies – you know, have a very complex matrix and reporting system. I think the more complex you make it, people are less likely to want to step up and practice it. But it should be an ongoing. There is no wrong time to do it. I think it's a better answer. It's how businesses grow and develop. You know, the strongest organizations out there seem to practice succession development very, very efficiently. Obviously, there are circumstances that come into play where, a premature exit of a critical member of management, maybe they're recruited away, maybe it's an early retirement. I mean, there could be a number of different reasons that, you know, you're not prepared. But again, it should be part of the responsibility. And, there will always be positions that are open that successors shouldn't take. It'd be premature, and you don't want to be irresponsible there. But again, it's a huge responsibility and one that we work very closely with our clients as part of our advisory services.
Well, Court, I thank you for your insight and perspective. It's been very enlightening, and as I often do, I learn a lot just by talking with guests such as yourself, and I really appreciate you shedding some light on executive recruitment, and look forward to talking with you in the future and possibly having you back on Franchise Today in the future. Again, thank you for being a guest on our show today.
Paul, thank you so much for the opportunity. Very much enjoyed it and would welcome the opportunity to come back.
And, of course, today's segment will be available on demand right after, probably within about 10 minutes after the show ends today. We did have a lot of people in the franchise community tap into that, especially over the weekend and now this time of the year as they travel to various franchise events. Joe, again, thank you for another great segment of Franchise Today.
Oh, you're quite welcome, and it's always a pleasure, and Court was a terrific guest, and if people want to learn more about Court and his company, they can simply go to hvs.com and learn a little bit more about what they do and how they do it.
And again, who do we have on next Thursday?
Next Thursday is Bob Coleman. We're going to talk about lending, talk about the SBA. We're going to talk about his book, and should be a very exciting show because financing of franchises in 2012 is what it's all about.
Well, great, and I'll be broadcasting live from Miami Beach next week. I'll be attending the Franchise Expo South, the big recruiting event down in Miami Beach with MFV Expos. For more information on that, look on Facebook. On the Franchise Expo South page, Joe, I'll be talking to you from the great city of Miami. Until next week, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.